One of the super awesome, wonderful things I love about Artemisia We Women is the We Women part. The fact that everybody's going to be looking at women and focused on women and talking about women and talking to women.
What I love about We Women is that we're basically calling on the people in the back. Because of the way society has been set up, women have been in the back. And now we're saying, no, come sit up front. It's time for your story, your discussion, your interview.
And what we hope happens with Artemisia We Women is that we help make the world better for everyone.
Hello, listeners. I'm Julie Proudfoot, and I am your host for We Women Podcast. And I am here with the creative team of Close the Book, audio performance of a wonderful play by Susan Glassbell. And I urge you, listeners, if you have not heard this brilliant audio performance, please go to that episode and listen for free. So I want to get this creative discussion started off by first just saying who I am with these fabulous, wonderful people. Daria Harper, Elissa Wolf, Sandy Spatz, Michael Lomanek, David Goodlow, Elizabeth Del Toro, and Charlique C. Roll, who is our director for this wonderful reading. So my first question to you, fabulous talent, is how does Close the Book deal with privilege? And what about that was interesting for you as an actor slash director on this project? Feel free to jump in.
I'll start. I think I also want to, we have Simon Hedger here with us as well. I think that one of the things that was really interesting about this play, especially in its treatment of privilege, obviously we have a character, Jansi, who is unaware of her own privilege, but also just the implications of what the privilege of others, how that has manifested in society. And I feel like we see that a lot right now. We see people who have had historical privilege who still live and walk in that privilege without regard of what the implications of that on the greater and general society and how that broadens us. And I think what Jansi brings, despite, you know, her own unknown history, is the opportunity that we have to challenge our own history, to challenge what we know, and to challenge how we choose to interact with that, to challenge how we shift the narrative and create a society that is like beneficial for all of humanity, not just for some and not for others. So I think those are some of the things that I saw through this play.
Thank you, Charlotte. That's lovely. And thank you so much, Simon Hedger, for being with us. I could have sworn I introduced you. So another introduction for Simon. Yes, Daria. Sure.
I think another aspect that I think is comedic and fun in the play is that there's a turnaround of the Jansi character thinking that being an outsider, being someone who isn't a member of the privilege, that's the class she really wants to be part of. And so she makes the rest of the people who seem to be in the mainstream, you know, seem ridiculous and something she wouldn't really want to be part of ever. And so it turns the whole view, and she's very reactive to the fact that finding out that she might be a member at all. So it's sort of a twist, and that twist is really fun, and it breaks things up and kind of takes the scar tissue off the subject a little bit.
Yes, I love that. I love her writing and humor and Close the Book. It's lovely. Yes, Sandy.
I also think it's a powerful message that we don't have to be our ancestors. We don't have to be our history, that regardless of where we came from, we have choices and we can make different decisions. And so Jansi, she has an opinion. She has a path she wants to lead. So it doesn't actually matter whether she came from privilege or didn't. She can make her own choice. But it's really interesting that it felt better to her to be part of a gypsy culture or not part of, you know, society. It's just like that gave her her power, but you can have the power regardless.
Yeah. And I want to jump on Jan C. in a moment, but first hear from Simon and then Michael.
Well, I was going to talk about Jan C. as well, actually, because it strikes me that her claiming of this gypsy culture, the Romani culture, because I think we should recognize that's arguably a slur. I don't think there's uniform agreement about whether the use of the word gypsy is always a slur currently, but it's kind of appropriative. So she sort of separates herself in, I think, her first line. She talks about herself as being free and one of the people that were never caught. And I don't know whether she's talking about having not been caught by society or worse, that she's not amongst the people who were enslaved. So she has this kind of pose of ancestry. She's you know, wearing it like somebody at a festival might wear a Native American headdress, you know. So to the extent that she is the feminist character, she's not really a very intersectional one. It's sort of based in her own freedom to express herself in the way that in the way that she wants. And that's a kind of expression of her privilege, I think, in itself.
Michael.
Yeah, I would agree that just struck me, that her being able to claim that she was part of the other is in a huge way her privilege. She gets to do that. But for me, one of the things, you know, privilege is something that we hear about and we see on the news, but this gave clear examples. And for me, the clear example of someone who's privileged is the ability to rewrite their own history, or at least to obscure the parts of their history that they want to. So that was a good thing that I learned from this.
That's great. Thank you. Thank you. This is specifically for you, Elissa. Is Jan C. a feminist character? And so why?
I did a lot of thinking on this question, because once you find out the twist at the end, where you find out that her heritage is not what she originally thought, because she really believed it. And so when you look at the play before you find out the twist, you see someone who is gung-ho about this heritage and where they come from. And I'm going to be an activist and I'm going to change things. And she starts to get a following. We hear that from Uncle George earlier in the play. So then when Bessie comes in and things change, it was interesting. I found an article and I was doing some research on it, because it was interesting for me originally at the end of the play that she doesn't choose to leave. She'd been talking about it. And then she decides not to. And originally I was like, well, isn't that kind of going against what she had originally spoken on and her original path? But the more I thought about it, I was like, but doesn't that also mean, in an appropriative sense, if she did leave, she's clinging to something that is no longer hers? So she talks about trying to be honest. It's one of her biggest qualities. She mentions a few times throughout the play. And so I think to some extent she realizes that to continue on that path is to not be honest and have a history and a heritage that she now realizes she is not a part of. But she then clings to the fact that there are disagreeable people even within society. And now she can cling to an actual family heritage and make it work with the path she originally wanted to go on, but now within this new, the new confines of, air quotes, being in society.
Yeah, I love that. And I also love how you talk about her flaws, right? Because so often when we talk about a feminist character and a female hero, we put a moral model on it that we don't always apply to men. You know, we see very, very flawed male characters and go, of course, they're allowed to be flawed. But when we see super flawed women, but somehow they're also very powerful women, and very dynamic women in their attitudes and their opinions and their spirits, like Jancy is, which is a wonderful spirit. She's very flawed, but she's very powerful in her spirit. And that's what I love about feminist characters at Artemisia, is we really celebrate the ones that are super flawed as well as those, you know, staunch moral good women that are feminists. So thank you for that. That's some great insight. I'm going to jump to something because I really want to hear from this wonderful cast about classism and how the privilege on the other side of the coin, right? Not the Jan C side, which we've talked about, but what's going on with the privilege in this university and this ancestry around this university? How does this playwright, what's interesting to you about the classism of this play and how she examines that?
Well, definitely something that I thought was kind of striking, that this play is pretty old, but a conversation that I feel like people are having in wider spheres is relatively new, is kind of the dirty money in prestigious universities. Just because if you make something that creates prestige and is made to bestow power and prestige on people for a long time, probably going to have a lot of morally unsound judgments made to keep that economic vehicle afloat. And it's interesting, you've been seeing like universities divesting their resources now out of like oil and gas, and talking about reparations for universities paying people whose families were enslaved and built the university. And it's just kind of striking, I think, that that's been an open secret since 1917, enough that it could be casually mentioned in a play.
That's great. Thank you, Elizabeth. Who else wants to jump on that?
I guess going off of the political aspects of that question, free speech, I feel like, is very much mentioned now. And it was still mentioned back then. I remember first going through and reading this and being like, this is really timely. When was this written? Because I just like jumped into reading it and hadn't really noticed. And then I went back and I was like, 1917. Well, okay. This still seems really relevant today. Especially, I think we can notice how, especially today with information, how people are picking and choosing. And we see a little bit of that in the end with the book as well, of, oh, we're going to say the good things, but there's also bad things. And what each person is clinging to back up their argument, I think, is we see that a lot today as well.
Thank you. Michael.
So, it strikes me that apparently the university has always been the dreadful hotbed of liberalism. And just some examples, I'm old enough that I watched the Vietnam War, and you know, the establishment was fearful of this new thinking that was coming out of universities back then. And with this recent administration we've had, and the disdain for the educated and for those hotbeds of liberal education, it seems to be timeless, and that's kind of sad.
I so agree with you. I think in this really wonderful little comedy, there's a lot of dark notes. You know, that mirror our failures to some degree. Right, as a progressive society, we seem to take one step forward for two steps back a lot. Great, these are all such great observations. I really appreciate them. I'm going to jump to, for time's sake, because I really want to hear from as many of you on these last two questions that we've always used at Artemisia, is at our fall festivals when we would do stage readings, which these audio performances are reminiscent of, right? When we would do new feminist plays, and ask two questions after the reading as moderation. Did the play empower women? Why or why not? And did the play challenge you to see women in a new way? So let's start with the first one, and it's anybody's game. Jump on in. Does this play empower women?
I think grandmother is clearly the matriarch and the leader of the family. Uncle George comes in, but it is the grandmother who says, close that book. So there's definitely female power lurking about in this show. And it's, again, that's one of those places perhaps where if we're trying to put the matriarchal leadership role as a positive, we see that it's not always positive. Sometimes they adapt the what the fellows do, you know?
Yeah, I have my hand raised. You probably can't see it because it's covered by this, by part of this wall here. But what I was going to say was pretty much echoing a lot with Michael was saying that, you know, like the structure of matriarchy is definitely in the background, which you oftentimes see where they're responsible for keeping things going, responsible for the events that happen, for the opinions that may, whatever opinions they may have. The male counterparts will oftentimes will react to those things. But one of the things that it seems to show that, you know, the status quo, this mindset of patriarchy is something that even women of like this particular class, they are very much invested in it because they have so much to lose from it as well. Although they're not necessarily regarded as to be equal at that time, they definitely have enough prestige to be able to look far down on others, where others will regard them as being something more than what they are or what they aren't. And you see a lot of that, I think, especially with Daria's character, where she did all of the actual legwork of figuring out what was really happening versus everyone else just talking and, you know, giving their elitist, you know, opinion on what they feel about a gypsy being in the family. But then she brings in the lawyer and his wife to be able to use as a reference to back up or to like sort of substantiate, you know, this her point by substantiating her point and saying like, look, I brought in a prestigious man and who has a prestigious position to back up exactly what I've been able to do all on my own. But I still need these people to be able to support my statement because it gives it more validity. So I think what it does, if nothing else, is just point out something that's still happening today, where a lot of people can't really say anything without having evidence from a status quo factor in order to prove their point.
That's great, David. Thank you. Anybody else on this play, Empowering Women? Daria?
You know, at first, when it starts out, it seems like it's going to be quite clear, this is a feminist young woman, you know, in the making during those times somehow, and that this story is going to be about that. But as it evolved, that broke down for me, and I feel like it became a global story about all genders, people. It's just about humans, and that no matter that human beings are flawed and great, and that's reality. And so, no matter what family line or where you look or what lens you look, you can always weaken the thread. So the arguments based on, you know, proving yourself by the goodness of your line, or, you know, is kind of ridiculous. It will never work out, you know? And so it stopped being a feminist play, but it was inclusive of all the men in the room and all the women in the room and all the people in the room. That's how it felt to me. So it sort of moved through feminism into That's how it occurred to me anyway.
That's a great point. I love that. Sandy?
I think I agree 100%. And I think it's interesting that as the grandmother, you know, I sort of, the status quo, you know, to keep things as they are, no secrets revealed, you know, that's, but as a feminist, as a woman, I don't think I feel particularly empowered unless I'm telling the truth. And unless I'm coming out of my history and making something different for the future. So I didn't feel empowered. I felt sad. I felt for her that she, you know, everything has to remain undercover. And, you know, we will live this life of privilege and we will not question it and we will not look too deeply into our history. And that's just not empowering, I don't think.
Yeah, I'm going to jump in on that because I think it brings up a really good generational point that we see through the two generations that are in the show. And that idea of like, this is the way that it's always been versus this is what we're trying to do now, which I think is really well done with how the characters are written.
Thank you both, Sandy and Elissa. That's lovely. And I think I'm a sucker for generational stories because I think so many times, and those plays are great, but so many new plays, everybody on stage is the same age. You know, everybody's 20, everybody's 30. And I'm like, yeah, but, you know, let's get some intergenerational arguments up here because it's always so, you know, it's always so classic and it's always so funny and it's always so interesting to bring out how even the older folks have really failed and the younger folks are fighting against what they might end up doing. And there's so much irony in it that I guess I'm a sucker for it. Yes, Michael.
One thing as a performer, I am drawn, I guess, most to Bessie and Mrs. Bird, because both of those, for me, got the most laugh lines. Like if I had watched the show and I was leaving, some of the things that fly out of Mrs. Bird's totally practical mouth are just hilarious. And also with Bessie, her childlike glee at having discovered the skunk in the room. They're just delightful characters. And so, I mean, that's, I'm not sure how that ties into everything, but I do find those two to be the strongest, most appealing characters. If I were going to go for one of the roles, I would go for one of those two.
That's great. That's great. A last question. Was there anything in this play that challenged you to think about women in a new way?
I don't know if this was a change on my perspective, because I've known many, many funny women in my time. But Michael was talking about those two characters being all the laugh lines, I think it's also an interesting distinction that Bessie and Mrs. Bird are both doing laugh lines because they're playing with like the actual premise of what's happening in the scene, as opposed to a lot of times, especially in older plays, women might be the funny characters, but it's because like, oh, these goofy women who don't know what's going on. But it was kind of their laugh lines were mostly observational of exactly how much they understood what was going on. And I think that's a cool distinction.
Yeah, she wrote a lot of smart women who were very aware. And yeah, that's a great point. Anybody else?
Well, just to add to that, smart women and kind of laughable men. I find Peyton kind of ridiculous and rather pathetic. You know, he speaks of freedom of speech and changing the world, but is unable to leave behind a turkey dinner. You know, so I didn't find much to like in him, which that was enjoyable. You know,
I love that, Simon. I think that I love the kind of reversal on the trope of the madly in love kind of sappy girl and the, you know, freedom loving, outspoken, you know, male that's going to get them. And she just reverses it. So we have this very funny, different,
quite,
you know, take on the young man. Yes.
I think that's the kind of fun thing that we see throughout this. When we were doing our rehearsal, we talked about how a lot of the conversational points are generated by the women in the room. And again, I think that's impressive and interesting for the time that it was written. When we look, just like as Elizabeth said, a lot of the plays that we've seen prior with the women are kind of laughable, but they're bringing up actual talking points that are generating conversation. And we even, you know, hear from Mrs. Root how, you know, she went to university. And this is, so then you see that history of educated women. But I think that's the challenging view as well, is that some of them are educated, but they want education to a point. And what does that really mean? So I think that's where you get Jancy's character kind of shaking everything up. You said education for all. Doesn't that mean all?
These are all such great points. Thank you all so much. Well, I want to thank this wonderful team so much for being with Artemisia We Women for the audio performance of Close the Book. If you have not heard it, I strongly urge you to go to Artemisia We Women and listen to this brilliant audio performance. And then this fabulous creative discussion will make a lot more sense to you. Thank you all so much for being with us. Join us next time on Artemisia We Women podcast.
I'm Julie Proudfoot.
And I'm Willow James. Visit artemisiatheater.org to listen to our podcasts and learn about our 2021 virtual season. You can also find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Artemisia Theater.
Thanks to our listeners, donors, and sponsors. Please take a moment to rate and review Artemisia We Women podcast to help new listeners find our fierce feminist audio performances, discussions, and interviews. And be sure to share our podcast with your friends. Artemisia We Women. We empower together.